ready? Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Mason Van Howling, Chair of the Facility Advisory Board for the Southern Nevada Health District, and I would like to call the January 23rd meeting of the Facilities Advisory Board to order. First, I would like to take public comment. Oh, I'm sorry, roll call? Okay. Before we get started, I would like to take a roll call to make sure that we have a quorum for this committee. So, Edie, if you won't mind calling the roll.
Thank you. Do we have any, do we have Boulder City Hospital on the line? Anyone from Dignity Health?
Yes, here, Laura Hannum.
Anyone from HCA?
Adam Rudd.
Todd Sklamberg?
Todd Sklamberg.
Jeremy Bradshaw, Mountain View.
Adam Rudd, Southern Hills.
Thank you. Mesa View Hospital? Michael Callahan? North Vista?
Vince, where are we out here?
Ross and Neal? Dr. Gallivan? UHS, Valley Health Systems?
Yes, Sam Kaufman from Henderson Hospital.
That was Sam Kaufman from Henderson Hospital?
Yes.
Perfect, thank you. Anyone else from UHS?
Elaine, Valley Hospital.
Got Elaine.
Ryan Jensen, Desert Springs.
Ryan, thank you.
Alan Eakes, Spring Mountain.
Thank you. Do we have the VA, Peggy Kearns?
Yes, this is Peggy Kearns.
Hi, Peggy.
Hello.
And West Care, Robert Vickery? We have quorum.
Hey, thank you, Edie, and thank you for everyone in attendance and on the phone. We've got a very good agenda. With that, I'd like to make a motion to adopt the agenda for January 23rd.
I'm sorry, public comment.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Dr. Eisner. Public comment. Is there anyone that would wish to speak about anything on today's agenda? If so, please step up to the podium. Seeing none, hearing none, we're going to move on to the adoption of the agenda for January 23rd. So can I have a motion to adopt the agenda?
Motion to adopt.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Moving forward here, next we have the approval of the consent agenda. And on our consent agenda is our minutes from our November 13th meeting in 2017. Can I get a motion to approve those minutes? Hopefully everyone's had an opportunity to review and approve them, or review and make any suggestions. Can I get a motion?
So moved.
Thank you, Todd. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you. Agenda item number 5, report and discussions. We are going to receive a report from Marlo Tonge related to our update on the county's harm reduction efforts. And Marlo's presented to us in the past, so she's going to give us an update on all the things that she's working on in her office.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Track B. I've got a couple of different things I want to talk to you about. But Track B is the local needle exchange here, located 6114 West Charleston Boulevard. As of February 2017, when they had started, as of today, they have passed out close to 150,000 syringes and needles. They have collected about 80,000 dirty needles and syringes, and they have placed thus far 3 vending machines, which I talked to you about the last time I was here. The vending machines are, for those of you that don't remember, are large. They look like vending machines, like a Coke machine or Pepsi, and they distribute boxes with clean syringes and needles, safer sex material, condoms, lube. They also have, this year, they started also adding Narcan to them. We were able to place 3 machines, but they've got additional funding to place 2 more machines in Henderson this year, so we're excited about that. They also got, they are piling this really new, this really cool new machine from Stiles. It's called, it's an autoclave grinder. It's about the size of a coffee machine, and what it does is it, the needles and syringes they get from the individuals that are coming in to exchange, it autoclaves it to temperatures, so to sterilize it, and then the bottom falls out and it goes into a grinder and it and mulchifies it into like confetti. And then it's safe to throw away in the regular trash. They're looking at, they're piloting the machine right now, so we're excited about that because you know as well as I do, and I remember the last conversation we had about biohazards and the cost of dealing with that. So they were able to get this machine as a pilot project. The machine's run about $50,000, so we're excited about what that opportunity might look like for us in the future. We also secured additional funds from Prevention, and were able to do a redirect based on disease here in Nevada with regards to HIV and hepatitis. And they allowed us to purchase additional two machines for Esmeralda and Story County. CDC identified those particular two counties as high risk for HIV and hepatitis outbreaks due to needle use. So this year, we're working with the state to be able to work with those county and some of the county members to be able to place machines out there, also training and also Narcan training. So we're excited. That's kind of some of the things that we'll be working on this year for Prevention dollars. We also, Dr. Iser wanted me to talk to you guys a little bit about safe injection sites or safe consumption sites. They are gaining a lot of traction here in the States. There's about 100 sites worldwide. The last one, I think, was placed in Vancouver a few years ago. Vermont and Seattle, Washington, are looking at changing legislation right now to be able to allow for them. The benefits of a safe injection site, from what I understand, is that they are these individuals that are going to those sites, they get safe equipment to inject drugs. They are it's managed by healthcare providers, and the it's reducing the improper syringe disposal and public drug use that people are having problems with. The Drug Alliance Policy Alliance community is doing a lot of education and a lot of webinars around these forums. They were looking at San Francisco and New York being an additional site, but Seattle, which doesn't surprise me, has kind of beat them to the mix. And my understanding is that there are they're working on legislation right now to change it so they allow for these sites to be basically set up and distribute. I didn't know if this was appropriate, but I did. There's a webinar on February 1st where they're starting to have some real conversation about what the next steps in harm reduction is, and that's these bases. So I printed off a couple if you're interested in maybe learning a little bit more about that. But I thought I'd give that to you. The other thing we're working on is peer navigation, and I've invited Dr. Dixon and Krista Hills from Center for Behavioral Health to talk a little bit about their new role in peer navigation and dealing with the opiate overdoses in Clark County. We've been working, the Office of Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance have been working with Donna, who is the Executive Director from Foundation Recovery, which is right down the street, conveniently, to develop a peer navigation program or enhance the program that they have. Most of the individuals we work with that are with regards to infectious disease have co-occurring conditions, we all know that. So we are looking at expanding our training and understanding around these populations with regards to harm reduction and being able to work with them to help link them into services and get them into treatment faster. In doing that, I found out earlier last week that Krista, who is from Center for Behavioral Health, was able to get funding from the state to be able to work on some of these issues in peer navigations kind of at a top, a systems top approach. So I'm going to invite Krista up, and Dr. Dixon, are you going to, is it Krista? Both? Okay, Krista's going to talk. To talk just a little bit, we're trying to keep it quick, but about 10 minutes, so she can talk a little bit about what they're trying to do, because it involves a lot of you. So I thought I'd invite her. So.
Thank you, everyone, for having me today. Don't mind my notes. I tried to make this as quick as possible for you guys. So, Center for Behavioral Health is an outpatient substance use treatment facility. We're level one, so strictly outpatient. We specialize in opiate addiction and doing medication-assisted treatment for opiate addiction, so methadone, Suboxone, Vivitrol. We're also doing outpatient counseling without medication, as well as like anger management, impulse control, court services and assessments. We're currently doing all the medication-assisted treatment for the VA, as well as we're the referral resource for Nevada Parole and Probation for all of their outpatient substance use counseling. Back in November, so this is all fairly recently, we received the STR grant from the state, so the state targeted response to the opioid epidemic. With that, we are now tasked to bring on a couple of different services to Las Vegas. One of those is bringing peer navigation and peer recovery to more providers, getting it out there. We're going to have them on site available to our patients as well as on an outpatient basis. We have 4 clinics here in Las Vegas. It's currently serving over 1,200 patients that will have access to peer recovery services. We're also, and this is where you all come in, developing a mobile outreach team that will send a licensed clinician and a peer recovery specialist to the hospital in response to an overdose. And that can be any substance overdose. It doesn't necessarily have to be opioid related. What we'll do is with that, per the grant, we will get them into treatment within 48 hours of that initial contact, whether it's services with us, whether it's with Westcare, whether it's residential at Las Vegas Recovery Center, whatever it may be. We're in the process of also getting certified for transportation so that once they're discharged from the hospital, we can take them to where they're going to get into treatment at. We're also working with the health district. If that person's not ready to get into treatment, we're going to do a harm reduction kind of piece with them, getting them those exchange kits from Track B or Naloxone, whatever it may be, and letting them know, hey, we're here when you're ready to get treatment. So we came today so that we can connect with as many of you as possible, because obviously we need the hospitals involved for this mobile outreach team. So I'd love to connect with as many of you as possible at the end of the meeting so that we can start getting those teams established and see what exactly your hospital is going to need and what's going to be the best fit for them. So, any questions?
No, I think that's a great update. I think we're all interested in that. And perhaps, is there a contact?
Yes, I have my cards as well as brochures and everything, as many of you. We're obviously going to start small, a couple of hospitals at first, but this is a model that nationwide, the programs that started with just weekend hours, a few weekends a month, grew within a year's time span to being 24/7 services. So we're hoping to connect with as many people as possible.
And I think that's great, especially with some of the new regulation that went into effect January 1st as far as opioid provider consent, and then also notification of an overdose, whether it's legal or illegal. Mm-hmm. So I think that would really fit nicely with the hospitals and are doing in the community. So we would love to connect with you on that program.
Mason, this is Sam. Question for the people that aren't in attendance there, could they follow up, please, individually through email, just so we can get them point of contact?
Yes, absolutely, Sam. I think this is really a worthwhile program, and ED will send out the contact information to be able to schedule appropriately, probably with our emergency departments and our intake areas of the hospital. So thanks, Sam.
Perfect.
We'll get
you.
That out. Great. Great job.
So just so we're not using euphemisms, you know what a safe injection site is?
I've studied it, but okay. Why don't you, Dr. Eisner, go ahead and...
It's a place for people to come who use injection drugs where they should have no fear of the police or sheriff's department, and where harm reduction activities can occur, and where I've seen these start to develop. It's really where access to care to get off the drug is one of the places to do it, just like Track B in the program that we have there. That's an access to care and harm reduction as well. One of the issues that the Big Cities Health Coalition, of which we're part of, is looking at is exactly that. And so I represent a lot of the big cities on that coalition looking at it. So thank you, Marla, for bringing that up. Do you have anything else to add? Okay. I just want to make sure that we aren't using euphemisms and or you don't understand what we're not quite saying or whatever.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Iser. Next, moving on to item number two, receive and discuss report from John Hammond, update on the health district procedure, maintaining EMS operations during hospital internal disaster declarations. And I think this is just a very appropriate time to remind, as we're all busy with unprecedented growth and in the midst of a flu season and upper respiratory, just to review the district procedure on maintaining EMS operations. So Mr. Hammond's going to take us through that, but and then we'll have a discussion once he's completed. So hopefully everyone has that handout with the, it's page 125 and it was in the email that ED sent out as well. So Mr. Hammond's going to review that for us.
Yes, quite a few years ago, we experienced an incredibly high volume based on a really horrible influenza season. And we've been pretty lucky the last couple of years, but this year, it's through the roof. I'm looking at the stats from our epidemiology department. It's just the streets must be running with flu people everywhere. I don't go out there anymore. Save yourselves. So we regionalized the valley and the hospitals, the acute care facilities, and in an effort to keep EMS traffic flowing, we set a trigger number based on how many hospitals are within that particular region, and a hospital may go on internal disaster, and then another hospital may go on internal disaster, and perhaps a third one may want to go on, but that kicks everybody off in a particular region, specifically in that regard, the central region where it's three, and then everybody gets kicked off. The smaller regions, you know, one can be on internal disaster, and the next one will kick them off. This works out pretty well. It was recently tested, and just to say, luckily enough, it was during business hours when I received phone calls from both facilities and from EMS providers saying that there are three hospitals on internal disaster. We were able to address that in the central region. So we sent emails. We opened everybody back up again and went on with our day. The problem being is if that happens at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm not monitoring that system at 3 o'clock in the morning or when I'm on vacation. There's nobody to monitor that. So Dr. Young and I discussed possibilities with the state representative, Rodney Wright, who runs the website, and we came up with a way to automate how these things are being handled, because to be very honest, some people go on internal disaster and they walk away and they never monitor it again. And then when shift change ends, it gets missed in the rush, and I get it. You guys are super busy in the EDs. I get that. That's not an issue. But sometimes it gets missed and people are on internal disaster for elongated periods of time. So in discussing with Rodney Wright and Dr. Young, we are going to be instituting a sort of a time limit policy where you'll go on internal disaster. Time starts in 90 minutes. After that, if you want to remain on internal disaster, someone has to input that information. Otherwise, the system will automatically put you in the open status. Additionally, if within a particular region, people go on internal disaster and it hits the trigger point of having to force everybody open, it'll do that automatically as well. And it'll change your status from internal disaster to forced open, so everybody knows that you've been dealing with a high volume and you were forced open, and kind of give you a little deference if it's possible. After 90 minutes again, the forced open will go away and you'll be placed in the open category. So it requires your employees to be able to input again, okay, I want to go back on internal disaster or I want to remain open. But it automates it to a great extent. It allows for greater flow during those off hours when I'm not monitoring the system and others are not, and I don't receive those phone calls. And I think moving forward it's going to be a bit better and being a little bit more seamless in how we deal with this. Any questions?
And I think that if there, I always don't choose my words appropriately, but let's say there's an ammonia spill or there's a fire,
right,
that's a different issue than what
Correct.
We're talking about
Correct.
Here for just being inundated with influenza kinds of activities.
And that's a good point, Dr. Arzner, because that is spelled out, that there is a flood or a fire within a facility that's noted in the system. But I don't know how the rest of the committee feels about this, but sometimes internal disaster, I think we all know what that means internally, but the public outside, and has there been any discussion perhaps changing that language, because it's really a capacity overload or a volume issue, maybe a capacity 1, 2, or 3, or green, yellow, red type of situation. I just think our community and the average patient or the doesn't realize, they think the worst, as Dr. Eisner just pointed out, internal disaster, meaning something that's critically wrong with the facility, not their ability to offload patients or longer wait times out in the waiting room. Has there been any discussion about perhaps the language around that?
There has been some inroads to that during MAB. Some of the board members there are starting to discuss that a little bit more. The term itself is older than my tenure here, when they started negotiating what internal disaster is and what that encompasses. And at that time, it was, you got an active shooter, you're on fire, you got ammonia leak, your O2 tank has been breached, right, by some reason. Those were the reasons. And then it came up, well, staffing's an emergency too, so that got lumped in. So having a discussion, I'm amenable to that. But that'll be run through probably MEB as well, and you guys can certainly attend to those meetings and have your voices heard as well. It seems to make some sense, but we'll discuss that. Actually, makes a lot of sense, not some. I apologize if that was...
Yeah, no. I just think, just clarification, because volume and staffing are...
Dr. Young may have something to add.
Okay.
Dr. Young? There is history here with this. There was a time where we would go on divert or go on bypass, and it was happening so frequently that, you know, call it what you will, it's everyone's problem when it starts happening. And so most of the time it was for volume, but many different reasons, and so... There were discussions, and this was also before my time, but I have gone back through the minutes, and there was a discussion to let's get rid of this term. We're no longer going to divert, we're no longer going to bypass. But you can't get rid of it completely, because there are going to be infrastructural issues, flooding, things like that, where it is truly unsafe to bring a patient there. And so we had to leave something in there. And I think, just as you say, like with time, there's been some mission creep there, and we've come back to having capacity to a point where it is potentially a dangerous situation, where folks resort to calling this internal disaster, even if it is to just divert traffic temporarily. So it's gone back and forth and ebb and flow. We're a different system now than when this discussion had happened in the past. So in the initial part was just to keep that terminology of internal disaster. Dr. Eisner brought up the point, is there a national terminology for this? Not really, not in this particular thing. The internal disaster came up, you know, here locally. But we kept the terminology there with the understanding that, well, when you put in that designation, you're going to put in why. If it is just for capacity, if it is for staffing or beds or chemical spills, active shooter, things like that. And that's been part of the challenge, is when folks are going on internal disaster, they're not filling out that information. So it's just internal disaster, not otherwise specified. To the point when we did actually have an active shooter at a hospital, ambulances were still showing up there. This was years ago, but that potential is happening because we are not, there's not a hard stop to put that reason for why the internal disaster. So you bring up a great point. I think, you know, call it what you will. If it is diversion or bypass, I have no problem calling it that, to reserve internal disaster for something that is more appropriate for what that term conveys, you know. So
I would be open to exploring, this is Todd Sklemmerich, Sunrise Hospital, to exploring that language as well, and having specificity on the reason that one closes or goes on internal disaster, because it's an issue that I think every hospital in the region or in each of the sections needs to face and work collaboratively. I'd also encourage transparency in reporting when and aggregate data, be it on a quarterly, annual basis, on the frequency and the reasons for going on internal disaster, both to allow us to plan more globally as a community if there needs to be additional ER resources, but also to hold each other accountable. Because when one goes on internal disaster, it puts significant pressure on the other hospitals within that region. In a couple of cases, at Sunrise, when we've had two hospitals in the region on internal disaster, if we chose to go on internal disaster, we could have forced everybody open. And I don't think that's right, you know, either. We were dealing with an inordinate amount of holds. So I think working through the rationale, encouraging each of our facilities to be certain we have rigid procedures before an institution does hit that button the system to go on to internal disaster, and then to have transparent reporting,
that's
to the community.
Important part. And I know several of you have heard me on conference calls this time of year for at least 2 years in a row, but it's been over 2 years where I have to ask you to go off internal disaster because it is inundating the other hospitals in that system. And I know, I think you've been on those calls, Mason. I know you have, others have been too. So what we have put into place tends to minimize the need to do that, but I agree with you fully. We need to, all of the hospitals need to be more fully transparent.
And it sounds like some of these new automated mechanisms that
will
you've
help.
Been able to work out through the HABED system will trigger that 90-minute evaluation and then circle back. I think, as Todd mentioned, we all need to encourage our staff to put in the reasons so we can track it. And I'm not sure, John, if we track that through the Medical Advisory Board as far as the trends and
we started doing it through the ED EMS Leadership Committee. And those are, if you put it in the system, it's trackable and transparent. So I can generate a report whenever we started doing this and let folks know when they went on internal disaster, for how long, what the excuse was, if any was given, on a whatever basis, whatever time frame you would like to hear. And if that is a request of this board, I have no problem doing that for the next meeting as well. If you'd like to see that for the last quarter, that'd be fine. That's not a huge deal. So there is transparency inherent in the system. It's when some facilities call dispatch and say, we're getting hammered, could you stop for a bit? You know, that data I would not have.
Right. And so when do these new automatic triggers go into place? Is that in effect today, or
no, I wasn't going to turn this on until we had a discussion.
Oh, okay.
Surprise, you know. We have to get back with Rodney to make sure that the vendor, Intermedics, was able to implement those changes, and then they can just turn it on. I will certainly send out an email prior to that happening. If there's a problem with Intermedics and the way they did the back end of this, so before we even start, you'll get an email in that regard.
Does anyone want to make a motion? I'm supportive of that, at least from this board, but would like to get the consensus that are we supportive of the mechanisms that Mr. Hammond's laid out as far as triggers to be able to go on capacity or overflow, or anybody else want to support that as a recommendation?
Part of that, it's going to take a little bit of time to change that terminology from internal disaster to anything else. It's structural. It's in the system. It's operationalized. So we have to change a whole bunch of stuff before we can just say that's no longer internal disaster, now it's capacity, or whatever other term we come up with. So please bear with us as we move forward with that. It may take some time, and I don't have an estimate for the time that it's going to take.
Just at least ensuring the reason codes behind that, so you can
right.
pull accurate data, whether
yes.
it's staffing or some type of flood yeah. or capacity. So
thank you.
One other thing I noticed in the procedure, we've got Henderson Hospital, which is, that's great, in the south. We've also have other hospitals that are licensed in the community. Do those need to be considered as far as appropriate placement? And then we've also got some of the freestanding EDs. Do they fall into this particular protocol?
Receiving facilities do, with the exception of the freestanding EDs, because their volume is so low anyway. If they want to close their doors, close your doors, notify us. But they're in the EM system. They're in the system that tracks this, but they're not considered part of this because of their volume is so low from EMS, on the EMS side. So we did not consider adding them. Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking
that'll tip the scale a little bit if you start adding these.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just thinking, just because we need every bed in town, every ER bed, inpatient bed, to be able to decompress. So I just think from a fairness standpoint, some consideration should be given if we're going to, you know, we've added four more licensed hospitals and we've got some more freestanding EDs. I would just hate to have them not in the mix of being able to help decompress emergency department, especially during this time of year. So somehow that has to be kind of considered in as a medical asset for our community.
They're certainly capable of taking those patients that the protocol drives to them. That's up to the patient themselves and the crew being a patient advocate saying, okay, hospital A is super duper busy, but there's a freestanding ED right here that can probably see you a little bit quicker. So we actually try to empower the crews to make good decisions as good patient advocates. Sometimes it's an uphill battle, sometimes it's super easy. Right. So moving forward, we're continuing with that type of education as well, that this particular type of patient doesn't need to be seen at a large acute care hospital, but can be seen at a freestanding ED like the Dignity or here at the Lakes.
Right. And I'm Laura Henham from the Dignity Health St. Rose Dominican Neighborhood Hospitals. And John, I know you and I have had plenty of conversations, as I have with Dr. Young as well. So I think it's always important to make the distinction that I agree, all the facilities, critically important. Freestanding ERs, of course, do not have an inpatient component. The neighborhood hospitals, I know Dr. Young is fully aware, do have the inpatient capabilities. So I don't, I would posit or maybe make a request, John, that maybe now would be a reasonable time to revisit the protocols. I know that there was some discussion when the neighborhood hospitals were approved for incoming EMS traffic under those protocols, and there was some discussion that maybe there would be a reasonable time in the future to revisit those relative to those facilities that have the inpatient capabilities versus those that may not. So maybe there's a recommendation that timing, given the stressors, given the volume demands placed on various facilities, that given that it largely turns, to your point, John, turns on the protocols, that maybe now would be a good time to revisit since there are changes in the market.
Mm-hmm. We'll be happy to look at that.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure if we have the Dignity facilities or the other emergency departments in the HABVET system. Are they even loaded so EMS can see that? Or
I believe the Dignities are in ER at the Lakes. I remember seeing them in there.
Right. So ER at the Lakes being an HCA facility.
Right. As a department of the hospital. So I think there's a difference when we look at the facilities as a department of the hospital versus a freestanding. And I think as we continue the discussion with these mini micro hospitals that are now being talked about, it may be worth broader discussion as to what the responsibilities of each of those facilities are, and then back to the various committees that are taking a look at EMS protocols right now.
Yeah, the discussion has been ongoing since the beginning of the process when the ER at the Lakes was first opening up. So, in fact, Dr. Young and I were discussing it just today about placing it on the next QA, not this month's QA committee meeting, but the next month's, to take a look at that as well.
Good. No, I think this is a great discussion, very timely, but also we need to be able to utilize all of our assets and resources in the community to help take care of our patients. So, so any more discussion on that particular item? If not, we'll move on to number three, which I think we kind of crossed into a little bit, Mr. Hammond. Receive and discuss a report on specialty clinical hospital standards of care, which I think the intent was really remote outpatient ED alternatives. So I think we kind of crossed into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's looking at the criteria related to the freestanding emergency departments and the neighborhood hospitals on what their capacity is and services, whether related to burn or trauma or behavioral health patients. I think that's all vetted out in the medical advisory board.
Correct.
Okay.
So. Correct. The initial process, I researched how other systems endeavor to make this work. Since it was inaugural here, I engaged Dr. Iser quite early in the process to let him know what was going on, and you're the boss, I gotta let the boss know, and to let him know what was going on with this. Through that process, which was several months in the making when ER at the Lakes first started their application process, We researched, we went through the Texas model where they have a ton of these type of facilities. We copied and pasted their protocols and changed it ever so slightly to meet our needs locally. It seems to work there. It's working okay here as well. But in the time that has been in full swing within the newer, all Dignity hospitals are now open. York Lakes is now open. We may be able to get a better, better bit of data to determine how that's working out for us. The protocol is conservative, but it serves the population that would best be seen at those particular facilities, with safety being an issue, obviously, and patient choice being paramount. They get to decide. They're the citizen that gets to drive their own healthcare. So while we can say this is it's a slower facility, they really see you quicker, yeah, but I want to be seen at hospital, whatever. And then the crew will say, then we're going there. You drive your own care. So moving forward, we're going to continue to discuss this as well.
And that committee will be the medical advisory board or the emergency medicine?
Medical advisory board will
ultimately
will refer probably to both the drug device protocol committee and the QA committee to determine if any change needs to be made.
Okay. And I guess consideration too of multiple transfers would be a concern as far as education and capacity, capability of a particular location, because certainly we don't want to.
Yeah, transfer it out. I mean, that if you take an ambulance and I take it to a off-site ED or a freestanding micro hospital, and that patient has to be transported again, that serves no one well. It increases the burden on the healthcare system itself, and increases the burden on the EMS system too, because they've already finished their transport and they're turned around and they're doing it again. So we're going to try and limit that as much as possible. Like we do with most of our protocols, we're trying to limit that insofar as we can. Yeah,
and I was going to say, I agree with Mr. Hammond in terms of now that we've got several months of, you know, actual data, one of the things that I'd be happy to speak to as well as our experience in terms of, I couldn't agree more, no one likes secondary transfers. So if you were to take our North Las Vegas campus for Dignity Health, for example, we actually transfer out 4% of those patients who come to the emergency room there. Oftentimes it's currently is right at 4%. So it's a very small percentage. But those are the kinds of things that we could look at, the absolute actual experience, the acuity of the patients, transfer rate, overall volume. Happy to look at all that. And again, couldn't agree more in terms of really drilling down in terms of the capabilities and what our experience has been thus far.
Now, does that 4% include, is it just EMS transfers in that you then transfer out, or is that
no,
total?
That's total. Okay. That's the total number of ER patients who present at the North Las Vegas facility. And that, of course, has been the facility that's been open longest for us and as far as the neighborhood hospitals are concerned. So we've got, right now, that's the most robust data with the fourth facility opening December 12th. So still early in terms of that facility.
Which one is that?
Sahara.
Is that our neighbor down on Decatur?
Sahara and Decatur.
Yeah.
That's right. That one opened December 12th.
Car lot or whatever.
It was. Yeah, that's right. That was our only redeveloped site. That was a brownfield instead of a greenfield. So it was a former car dealership.
Looked at buying it for this. Got this building.
Okay. Well, both would be great uses for a former car lot.
And I know, I think I heard Mr. Rudd's voice on the phone, too. I don't know if Southern Hills had any thoughts either related to some of the protocols that we've been discussing.
Yeah, I think that from Southern Hills' standpoint, we've seen a very similar thing. We've seen about 16,000 visits in 2017. With about a 4.5 to 5% admission rate. You know, we've received some ambulances, and again, I think that they have seen acuity from every spectrum across the way. You know, I would argue that, you know, given that our medical staff is obligated to treat patients that come to that facility no different than the ER on campus, that our capabilities are fairly wide as far as what we can take care of. You know, from gunshot wounds to you know, just about everything that's come in. We've delivered a baby, the whole bit over there. So I think that they have been able to maintain fairly high quality. We had a STEMI there a couple of weeks ago. That door to balloon was 47 minutes, which included the transfer. So, you know, again, I think the processes have been ironed out, that the capability is pretty wide.
Very good. That's very helpful. And then we'll continue to monitor as our this environment continues to develop moving forward. So any other comments related to that topic?
I just want to raise one other quick point. I think hopefully we're at the lights at the end of the tunnel with the flu season. I don't know. I don't want to speak too soon. But from the EMS dispatch side, a lot of you have EMS backgrounds, which is awesome. But there is a, through the ProQA, the dispatch kind of algorithm that we use, there is a protocol. It's called Protocol 36 in that lineup, which is a kind of an optional protocol that kind of gets turned on, so to speak, in true cases of like pandemic influenza. It hasn't really happened, but it does exist in the lexicon of the fire alarm office and things like that to do this. It would actually be under the direction of Dr. Iser if it really got to that point. What that does is basically turns on the dispatcher's ability to say, hey, we're sending help, or hey, no one's coming, so, you know, get some Tylenol and Motrin, or truly trying to identify alternate transports. And that's why I really think the value of the, you know, alternate sites, the freestandings as EMS transports coordinated through the fire alarm office could really kind of really shine in that moment if it were to come to bear with that. But just to keep that turning back here at Protocol 36, just as a dispatch way to alternate traffic patterns going forward if it gets to that point. Hopefully it won't.
Very good. That was helpful. Thank you, Dr. Young. Okay, moving on to item number 4, receive, discuss, a report from Mr. Hammond. That's Mr. Hammond's show today, related to the Nevada Trauma Registry, and he's just going to give us an update. We've talked about this subject many times, and looking at our own product in the South, looking at the state's data, and from what I understand, we're getting some data finally out of the state that may be helpful in moving in the right direction. So, Mr. Hammond, provide an update.
We have suffered in the desert of no trauma data for so many years, and in that regard, Dr. Ezra directed our informatics staff to develop an in-house tool, data, or a trauma registry, while parallel efforts were being made at the state to revitalize the digital innovations product. So we developed our product. It is currently sitting on the shelf. It's ready to be used. but since that time, the trauma registry has become functional. Has become reliable, the state trauma registry, I should say, has become functional and reliable. First couple of years were a little shaky for the non-trauma centers submitting data. The compliance was fairly low. I just spoke with Tabitha Hart, who works at the registry, and their compliance is now 100% for non-trauma centers. Trauma center data, at least locally, we received from the facilities themselves, and then we'll start receiving them from the trauma registry as well, because we get a different data set from than the trauma registry for our own consumption. Last week or week before last, I sat in our informatics office, spoke with Lay. We tested the system in regard to its ability to generate reports on an ad hoc kind of basis. It functions fine. The amount of data there is really rich. For a motor vehicle accident, you can drill down to whether or not the person was sitting in the front seat, back seat, passenger side, driver's side, seatbelt, no seatbelt, airbag, no airbag, you know, those kind of data points, direction of travel, the whole stuff. So it's a rich data set that I think we can use to better our system in general on the trauma side. So I'm happy with what we're getting out of that registry at this time. Any questions?
And that information will be reviewed, I assume, in the Regional Trauma Advisory Board?
Correct. We report quarterly trauma statistics in the Regional Trauma Advisory Board. We also review it in the peer review committee that is not open to the public, the Trauma Medical Audit Committee. We review all those data. We weave in the non-trauma center data as we need, but the volume is still really low for non-trauma center data, that those individuals that meet trauma registry criteria, you know, there's exclusion and inclusion criteria like with any data set. So we use those numbers as well in trying to kind of plan ahead a little bit. It's very difficult though, and it is quite actually a moving target, so we try our best with that. So moving forward, I believe that we're in a better place than we have been in quite a few years. So I'm moderately excited about it, to be honest. We may be able to actually generate our own yearly report soon as some of the legacy data is uploaded.
We would like to do publishable reports based on this trauma registry data, and that's why John and Mike and Christian and I have been talking about how reliable is the data, because if it's not reliable, we can't do these reports. But for example, I would like to see a report on gunshot wounds. Probably most of us would. So that's one of the things that they have started to query the data bank about.
And are all hospitals reporting into this database?
Yes.
Okay. And we're getting everyone inputting the data and complying with the...
Yes, this last year, they've not had fourth quarter 2017 yet tidied up, if you will, but they've had 100% compliance with submission of the data, which is fantastic.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Hammond, for that update. Agenda item number 6, receive a report from the Chief Health Officer, Dr. Iser.
So I'll try to go through these relatively quickly, but they're important issues that I see us doing and starting to do and continuing to do over the next couple of years, engaging our Board of Health in a variety of issues. One is we've been working now for about 4 or 5 months with Dr. Antonina Capurro, who some of you may know, most of you may not. She's the state dental officer. State went without a dental officer, chief dental officer for, I think, decades. She has become a very good partner to us, and we're looking at using our mobile services van and taking some oral health, a dental hygienist with us going up into Lincoln, Nye, Esmeralda, and White Pine counties. As you know, they're not, as you should know, they're not fluoridated like we are, and then there are parts of our county that aren't fluoridated. So we're looking at how can we help to provide some preventative oral health care. The counties are starting to come back and tell us we want more than just preventative. We're not capable of doing that yet. Whether we ever will be, I don't know. We, as the Southern Nevada Health District, will be providing immunizations, and then we'll take along someone who can do Medicaid determinations in these rural counties. And depending on what they want, what we can do, what Richard Whitley will allow us to do, whether we can take a Social Security person with us so that people from Beatty and other places don't have to drive down here in order to apply. We do have some funding promised by the state. We will provide the van and our own personnel, but they'll be reimbursing us not for the van, but for the cost of operating the van, gasoline, that kind of stuff. The counties involved will provide security. They'll provide electrical hookups. They'll provide where we should go. They'll do the advertising for us. And then depending on what else they want in the future, they may have to pony up some dollars to do this. This is right on my mind. Ms. Glazier and I have just been talking about this. We're in the process of applying for a HRSA grant for general preventive medicine and residency, general preventive medicine and public health residency. What that is like family medicine, like any of a number of other residency programs, its own residency program to train physicians to have the qualifications that Dr. LeGuin, who is not here, and I have. When we searched, there are only 2 GPM public health certified people in the state, and they both work here. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is to provide training for general preventive medicine residents to upgrade the profession throughout the state so that a future state health officer will be a preventive medicine residency trained person. People who might work for Elko County or White Pine County or Washoe County would have this background, and this would upgrade the ability of rural counties, urban counties, to really do a better job in providing public health services.
Is that training time the same as
internal medicine or...
Yes, it is.
Medicine, it's 3 years?
Or? Thanks for the question. So it is a 3-year program. The first year can be done generally at a primary care residency, anything from family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, and OBGYN, which at the federal level is kind of classified as a primary care, to do the first year there. And then the second year will be the MPH, and we're partnering with Sean Gerstenberger, and what soon will be hopefully a school of public health, separate from the School of Community Health Sciences there. And then the third year will be here. And it could be that we might want to work with one of you or more of you to look at some sort of an occupational kind of a rotation, which is another specialty in public health. But looking at where else can we place folks if we start to get too many. So the State Health Department, either in Carson City or down here, Washoe County, and other places. Being involved with this mobile health services van, being involved with our homeless outreach, being involved in our own clinics here, but they do have to do residency rotations in the third year with epidemiology, surveillance, probably public health lab, chronic diseases, and more things than just what a family medicine person would do. And they have to have clinics as well. We have plenty of clinics. Our own accreditation, much like yours, where you've heard us talk about this before, we are in the last stages of uploading all of the documents. Legally, I have to push the button, and that's planned for January 31st, just a week away, more or less. We did a presentation for one of our boards today that showed that we are 98% ready to go. We still have a couple more policies we have to develop and put in, but those will be done by the end of this week. We hope to be able to upload on the 30th and for me to, or to get ready to upload and for me to push on the 31st. The next stages will be that the Public Health Accreditation Board will determine whether or not we've substantially met the underlying accreditation criteria, and then we'll schedule a site visit. So we'll have a mock site. I think, do you all have mock site visits? So we'll be doing what you do so that we can practice for when they come. So we're very excited about that. My guess is that about 20% of the public health departments, we're a district, but departments throughout the United States have successfully been accredited. Here in Nevada, only Carson City has, but we're ahead of the state, we're ahead of the Washoe County Health District, but they're not far behind us. So what we, of course, are trying to do to get all four of us accredited, and we'll be one of the first states that might have all locals, it's easier when there are only three, all locals and the state accredited. So we're excited about that. And then we've talked a little bit about FQHC, and that's one of the things that we're still working with our board to become a community health center like Nevada Health Centers and others. I think that you all know better than I do, certainly as well as I do, that there are broad swaths areas of our valley and the county as a whole that don't have good access for Medicaid patients to see doctors, that we're very underserved in terms of these kinds of facilities in Southern Nevada and the entire state of Nevada, and we're trying to convince our board to allow us to make that next step. So most of these are 501c3 not-for-profits like all the ones that you know about, but there is a provision for public health entities, a public option that they have to look like the rest of them, and so we're trying to work through what do those logistics look like, what would a board for us look like, and it has to be 51% users. So if there's a board of 9 people, at least five have to be users of the system. So we have to offer more than just primary care, but we don't even offer primary care yet. That'll be next baby steps that we're taking over the next several months to a year. And then oral health care we have to do. We do have a pharmacy. We do have a laboratory. And then behavioral health, I keep looking at my friend Dr. Dixon back there, that we would have to have access to that, as well as, and I think thank both of you for helping us to get some sort of privileges at your hospitals so that if we have to hospitalize someone, we can do that. But that's the other step that we have to take.
I'm sure you're watching what's going on in D.C. because that certainly is a funding issue for federally qualified healthcare centers, and I'm not sure if it passed. I know the CHIP.
I'm not
CHIP
either.
Is, CHIP did. But that's one that I didn't think it got is in the authorization, so we'll have to watch
it. It wasn't in the continuing resolution. And our fear is that there's another whole funding mechanism that funds 17% of CDC. It's the Prevention and Prevention and Public Health Fund. It does a lot of immunizations that come from CDC down to the state, down to us. But Congress has been talking about taking that funding and funding community health centers with it. So it's the Peter Paul principle of robbing one to give to the other. And we both are not as full as what we should be. Neither one of us is.
Thank you, Dr. Eisler, for your report. Moving on to number seven, agenda item number seven is emerging issues. Does anyone on the board or on the phone have any identified emerging issues that they would like to talk about in future meetings? We can certainly get that scheduled. Any other topics that you would like to see? Hearing none, we'll move on to public comment. This time is set for public comment. For those items that are not on the agenda, time is limited to 5 minutes, and looks like we do have one member of the public to speak. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is August Corrales, EMS liaison from the University Medical Center, also a paramedic here in the Valley, serving on the Drug Device and Protocol Committee with the EMS division. So I just wanted to publicly thank your EMS liaisons from HCA, Daniel Lamas, and then Valley Health Systems, Tony Greenway. Collaboratively, we were able to work through the peak disaster, the internal disaster periods. We were able to communicate with the North with Rodney Wright to discuss some ideas such as the forced open category. And then I'm looking forward to taking this to Drug Device and Protocol Committee with John Hammond and Dr. Young and work out a good resolution, and perhaps we can come with some better terminology, meaning at capacity, to address these issues, to separate true internal disasters from just being full and we're busy and we need to utilize the system. During this time, we also had input from Las Vegas Fire and Rescue, who were able to work collaboratively. We also looked at who was full, and then the EMS system as a whole. I just wanted to reassure you, we are looking at other alternatives to disperse patients throughout the valley, level loading, as we call it. So your EMS liaisons are working at the right level. Your EMS providers and transportation professionals are also working at the right level, looking forward to resolving this at the EMS level as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, sir. And it's nice to hear all the collaboration going on the committee. Yes, ma'am. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Dr. Leslie Dixon. Dr. Eisler has referred to me many times today. I'm going to change hats. I am also the executive director from the Nevada Psychiatric Association. And really, I'm just coming here with a question based on the new law and what came out from the medical board yesterday about overdose reporting. And I'm just kind of curious how the hospitals see their responsibility in this, because I think my members would like to know what their obligation is going to be, and are the individual hospitals going to take the responsibility for reporting to the chief medical officer, or are all of us as individuals going to need to do this?
Oh, thank you for the question. And I know the direction just really came out on Friday. I know we've got something from the governor's office on Friday. You know, a lot of initiatives were put in place the last legislative session, but really didn't tell you how to properly execute and report. So
why don't we agendize that for
okay. Yeah, that,
next
be great.
Time? That's
yeah,
a that's good a, issue.
That's a good idea. That allow us to all get back to on how to properly notify. And obviously, there are fines and penalties for not reporting. So I think that would be a great topic just to review it, look at the reporting requirements and some of the compliance around that. So,
just for information, that responding to a question is problematic under the public records,
yes.
Not public records, but the public comment,
comment
stuff. And so rather than do that here, let's do that in a more formal way with your permission to go forward.
I think everybody agrees.
It wouldn't chill her comment, I can guarantee you. We all know Dr., or at least I know Dr. Dixon well, but it can, and that's the issue.
That's right. So, any more public comment? Seeing none, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everyone on the phone.
Thank you.
Thank you, have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very efficient.
All right, yeah, I'll try to keep it an hour. That's my promise to everybody, an hour. Your time.
It was Dr. Dixon's fault.
Yeah, yes.
Just getting out of the Nevada, Southern Nevada Health District meeting.